Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by us, Capital Daily. With a committed audience of over 41,000 people, get connected with some of the smartest, hippest people on the West Coast. For more details, visit capitaldaily.ca. The Capital Daily's weekly photo challenge is back for another week. Each week, our team will post a weekly photo theme in Monday's Capital Daily newsletter, as well as announcing it right here on the podcast, with winners receiving gift cards to local Victoria businesses around town. This week's theme is favourite places to hike. To find out how you can enter, check out Monday's Capital Daily newsletter. Hi, I'm Ben Waterworth, and welcome to the Capital Daily podcast for Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. Today on the podcast,
the back and forth that exists between Hong Kong and Vancouver, I find fascinating. It's this sort of netherworld that occupies neither city properly.
We chat with South China Morning Post Vancouver correspondent Ian Young about his incredible career to date and the challenges of working for an overseas newspaper in a different country. Ian Young has worked and lived in Canada and currently serves as the South China Morning Post's Vancouver correspondent. Originally from Australia, Ian has worked as a journalist for more than 20 years and has worked for a variety of publications, including Australian newspapers and the London Evening Standard, before arriving in Hong Kong in 1997. During his time in Hong Kong, he won and shared awards for excellence in investigative reporting and human rights reporting, as well as taking home the Hong Kong News Awards Scoop of the Year. And to chat more about his amazing career and the work he is currently doing for the South China Morning Post, it's a pleasure to welcome Ian to the Capital Daily podcast today. Ian, first of all, welcome to the podcast, or as perhaps I probably should say, as one Aussie to another, g'day.
Yes, g'day, Ben. How are you?
I am going well, mate. How about yourself? I said to you just off air, it's always nice to hear the accent. I don't hear it that often, but it's always nice to hear it from time to time.
Yeah, there's a few of us around BC, mostly up around Whistler, I imagine. But, you know, there's a few of us knocking around.
Indeed. We can make the whole g'day thing happen in this part of the world slowly, potentially. I'd love to obviously chat a lot about sort of what you're doing right now and kind of what led you to where you are today with the South China Morning Post. But I'd also love to learn a little bit more about how you got to where you are today. So I guess let's go right back to the very beginning. I mean, what took you into journalism? Was this something you'd always wanted to do?
Yeah, no, it's something that I had always favoured. You know, I studied journalism at the University of Queensland, and I ended up working as my first job was for an outfit called the Sunshine Coast Daily, which is one of Queensland's premier provincial newspapers. And at that time, I was actually a cartoonist as well, so they got a kind of a two-for-one deal. I was a caricaturist slash journalist, and eventually I kind of segued into journalism quite squarely because that's where the big bucks are.
Well, I was intrigued about the whole, clearly, the massive bucks, absolutely. We're both very wealthy individuals, Ian. Whole cartoonist aspect, though, I mean, you'd write some pretty serious stuff over the years, but the cartoonist side of things is maybe a little bit of fun. I mean, is that something that kind of you fell into? Was that also a passion that you were just doing at the same time?
Well, yes and no. I would kind of dispute the idea that it's all fun and games. I mean, I got into it initially as a political cartoonist and a caricaturist, and I think that some of the most cutting observational journalism back then, and to an extent these days, is done by cartoonists. And I think that during the era of Trump, at least, we've seen a resurgence in interest in editorial cartooning. So maybe that can be my fallback, my retirement gig. But, you know, I've always seen them as quite analogous areas, you know, journalism and even investigative journalism and editorial cartooning. They do kind of go hand in glove to me. You know, I do see a serious side to the political commentary that you get from a good old-fashioned editorial cartoon.
I always enjoyed, when I've worked at newspapers, talking to the cartoonists because yeah, that sort of that fun side of things. But as you're saying, like, it's a really important medium to kind of have that satirical approach and really actually get some news out there and really have a message. I mean, do you find the pressures of coming up with a cartoon, whether you did it every day or sort of whatever time frame you did it when you were doing it, is harder than, say, coming up with a story by deadline? Because I can imagine they've got different ways about it in both aspects.
They're quite similar. I think that, you know, editorial cartooning is one of those kind of inspiration-based gigs, and it can be quite wearing to try and churn something out fresh on command. You know, I mean, art on command is always going to be quite tricky. And to that extent, I think that enterprise journalism is a bit like that. You know, when you're left to your own devices to come up with stories, to come up with exclusive and enterprise stories and investigative stories, compared to the, you know, not to disparage it, but the kind of, you know, sausage machine type daily grind of journalists, of pumping out the stories, which are important, but that happen to an agenda and are based on here is something that happened today. That's a different kind of pressure to the pressure of, say, you know, an editorial cartoonist, all the pressure that's on an investigative journalist. And that's kind of the thing that I'm focused on these days. So you never get away from the pressures of editorial work, but they're quite different, you know, different kind of stresses, I think.
Besides the allure of the big bucks of journalism, Ian, that you're talking about before, was there a specific sort of moment which kind of led you down the path of journalism as opposed to being a full-time cartoonist?
Well, I can narrow it down, is that I left Australia's sunny shores when I was, I think I was 25 or 26, to work overseas, as is the want of many a young Australian journalist. And it just became very, very difficult to make a go of editorial cartooning. When I basically wanted to make a living of journalism and working in newspapers overseas, and I was never going to break into Fleet Street as an editorial cartoonist. You know, there's a handful of those, and you know, the idea that I was going to be able to do that was a bit pie in the sky. And so I segued into you know, full-time journalism, sub-editing, editing, page editing, all those kinds of things. And you know, I managed to get a fairly good gig on Fleet Street, and that in turn led to a pretty good gig at the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong at the time of the handover.
And I could imagine that that's something you probably never imagined you would be doing. And as you say, you end up in Hong Kong in 97 during the time of the handover. So kind of a bit of a nice, interesting role, I can imagine, at a very nice and interesting time in the history of Hong Kong and the UK and China, of course. So, I mean, when you got that gig and you got posted to Hong Kong, what was that initial reaction when it was offered, and then when you arrived there, kind of having to deal with everything that was going on in Hong Kong at that time in history?
Well, it wasn't actually offered before I arrived. What happened was I went out to Hong Kong to cover the handover for the Evening Standard, for the Daily Mail. But in the end, they didn't end up and take my stories. They didn't end up and take anything from me, because I went out there as a freelancer, and, you know, a news editor would say, oh, yes, you know, give us a pitch, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But then when you end up in Hong Kong, this was the story at the center of the world. And, you know, there were an infinite number of people pitching stories. But what happened was I walked into the South China Morning Post, got to know a few people, and, you know, contacts being what they are, I managed to get shifts on the South China Morning Post. And that turned into an offer of a full-time gig. And I was actually working in Hong Kong on the night of the handover for the South China Morning Post. And it was, you know, it was quite an amazing thing to see history being, you know, written in the first draft on that night, and, you know, to soak it all in. It was an amazing time for a young journalist.
And it must be like such an amazing thing to witness it, as you're saying, because people know the history that's been made at that point, and it's a very rare opportunity for an individual to be in a position like that, let alone a journalist who has the opportunity to tell the story of history right there at that point. Are you able to soak in that moment on that night, or is it so overwhelming that you're kind of just doing your job that a couple of days later you maybe realise the gravity of where you were at that time?
Oh, no, I think on the night everyone who was there knew that they were seeing history. I was working through the handover, which was at midnight. And then after the newspaper went to bed, or at least one of the editions had gone to bed, myself and a whole bunch of other journalists, of course, we fled for the streets of Lan Kwai Fong and for Central to soak up all of the atmosphere of what was happening. I think that now, because the rise of China and the rise of Xi Jinping has cast a bit of a different pall over Hong Kong, it's easy to forget what an amazing moment this was for the city. And I think that although there were a lot of fears for the city at the time, there was also an intense air of celebration. And that's what happened on that night. There was, it was an amazing celebratory event for a lot of people. And I actually went up to the Lo Wu border at around 5 a.m., half full of beer and high spirits, and watched the PLA troops come in over the border in their armoured personnel carriers. And they were being cheered by thousands of people waving Chinese flags. And it didn't feel quite the frightening or intimidating moment that such a moment now would, be thought of in hindsight. There was a strong mood of celebration at the time. Of course, it's intimidating to see, these serried ranks of PLA soldiers standing in the back of these trucks and on APCs zooming over the border. But everyone was cheering, and it was a wild moment. And it was pouring rain as well at the time. It's something that I remember, over the 3 days of the handover ceremonies and celebrations. Hong Kong got, I think it was a meter of rain. It poured for 3 days. And, I remember coming back at about 7 o'clock the morning after the handover, drenched to the bone, to crash out and try and sober up for my shift that night.
Incredible, incredible. With the position then that you get at the South China Morning Post, you're then in Hong Kong, I guess, for a certain period of time. Tell us a little bit about your time there, some of the work you did, and kind of what your focus was when you were there in Hong Kong working for them.
Yeah, well, I worked in a number of the giddy heights of newspaper middle management for quite a while, and then I ended up as the foreign editor of the South China Morning Post. It was my most recent gig. That's on and off because I took a year off when I got married, and took a bit of a sabbatical. My wife being a journalist as well, but we both ended up back at the South China Morning Post around 2005, I think it was, and that was when I took up the position of foreign editor of the South China Morning Post, and that was an amazing period as well. So yeah, there was a lot going on.
And through that, several awards and accolades throughout the years. Obviously, none of us are high-paid journalists, Ian, go into it for that, but it's a nice little recognition every now and then. What were some of the honours and accolades that you received during that time?
I worked on a team won Hong Kong's Premier News Award, which was the Hong Kong News Awards Scoop of the Year. I won a Human Rights Press Award as part of those teams. Excellence in Human Rights Reporting from the Society of Publishers in Asia as well. Those kind of awards. And that you're right, that is very rewarding. But what is more rewarding is the kind of stories that we broke to win those awards. One of those stories was an amazing series of investigative reports about how the Thailand Navy was towing Rohingya refugees out to sea in these unpowered vessels, unpowered hulks, packing them onto these ships by the hundred, smashing the motors and just casting them adrift out at sea. And, hundreds of people died as a result of this secret policy. And the SCMP, through a series of front page stories and photographs documenting this atrocity, managed to shut that down and managed to end that, I almost call it a genocidal policy of the Thai Navy in doing that. And that was a very rewarding piece of work for me, probably one of the most rewarding pieces of work for me, and that a great tribute to the on the ground reporters who were reporting that story for the SCMP. It was an incredible series of reports.
Because that's sometimes, I think, particularly in today's media landscape, something that people often forget is the good that journalism can do and the stories that it can tell and the things that it can uncover. And at the end of the day, for most journalists, Ian. That's kind of why you get into the industry, isn't it? To tell those stories and to explain to the world what's going on. And if you can save some lives in the process, then that's obviously a massive bonus with that.
Yeah, I mean, it always makes me sad when I do see very good journalists, drift out of the game and end up working in PR or as government flacks or whatever, because I always think to myself, what are the stories that those people with their unique skills would have reported, and what are the stories that will not now be reported because of their absence from the journalism business? So I think it is very serious, and it's such a, I think that journalism gets a bad rap, but it is such an honourable profession. It's such an honourable, and it's such an honour to be part of that profession when you can change society for the better through persistence. It's not through being some sort of high-powered individual. It's through being persistent and asking questions and sort of not taking no for an answer when someone tries to tell you no. And I think that it always does worry me, this bad rap that journalism gets, because I do think that it's, you know, it's the backbone of democracy, and it's the background of backbone of social justice in a lot of places. And look, you know, and you can say quite clearly that places that do not have a free press do not have thriving democracies, and do not have a strong backbone of social justice.
And with that in mind, when you initially made that move to Hong Kong and started working for the South China Morning Post, what was sort of the key differences you found in reporting and styles that you were, say, used to in Australia? Because I can imagine that there were differences. I mean, there's always differences in countries, be them major or little, but what were some of the things that you found most different about reporting in Hong Kong compared to in Australia and the UK when you were there as well?
Well, I mean, I got my start in provincial journalism on Australian provincial newspapers. And while, you look at the kind of reporting that I've just described, you know, busting open this huge human rights atrocity in Thailand, and you look at, say, council reporting at the Maroochy Shire in Queensland or you know, some story about some hospital screw-up, you know, in Noosa. The core values of journalism that make those stories happen aren't that different. I think that it does come down to an ability to smell when you're being given bullshit,
yeah,
and to smell when something isn't right, and it doesn't matter so much what an official tells you, but you should be able to discern the bigger picture. And so I think that actually a background in provincial journalism, provincial Australian journalism, court reporting, council reporting, that kind of thing, actually sets up someone very well for these other big picture kind of roles. And I would say also too that the tradition of newspapering at the South China Morning Post at the time in 1997 drew very heavily on the British tradition of newspapering as well. So, you know, the couple of years that I spent on Fleet Street also set me up quite well for that.
And did that change much after the handover, kind of switching maybe more so to the Chinese formation of media as opposed to that British formation?
No, I mean, I think that the South China Morning Post, for better and worse, has always been reflective of Hong Kong society. You know, South China Morning Post is a microcosm in some ways of Hong Kong, and the SCMP has changed in the same way, to an extent that Hong Kong has changed. But I've always been very, very proud of the incredible work that the SCMP does. And sometimes, you know, the newspaper gets a bad rap, but in the same way that any hometown newspaper gets a bad rap. And, you know, what I would do is I would ask that people judge a newspaper on its stories and judge my journalism on its merits as well.
Yeah. Moved to Canada about 10 years ago to continue your work with the SCMP, something you still do to this day. What brought about the move to Canada and that opportunity, I guess, to kind of turn into the Vancouver correspondent for the SCMP?
Yeah, it is a good opportunity. It's a fantastic little niche that I've managed to sort of carve out for myself here. Back when I was the foreign editor of the South China Morning Post, it was really clear to us and to me that Vancouver and Toronto occupied a very special place in the Chinese and the Hong Kong mindset in ways that other cities do not, in ways that, say, New York or even Sydney or Tokyo or whatever do not. Because, you know, Vancouver and Hong Kong, to an extent, were kind of the same city, not sister cities. You know, people were traveling back and forth and occupying both cities at the same time. And there was this strong streak of transnationalism between Hong Kongers and Canadians. You know, there are 300,000 Canadian citizens living in Hong Kong. You know, they're by far the biggest contingent of foreign citizens. There are more people from Vancouver in Hong Kong than there are all Americans in Hong Kong. And so there was, you know, you swing a stick in Hong Kong and you'll hit someone from Vancouver. And in fact, my wife is a Vancouverite, and we were both working at the SCMP at the time. You know, we married in Australia, and then we had a year off, and then we went back to the SCMP, and then in about 2009, 2010, decided to call it quits in Hong Kong and moved out here and was asked to stay on for the SCMP, and here we are today.
Was that a role that had existed in Vancouver, or was this something that they kind of were branching out, given that massive connection to the city, that they then thought, well, this would be a good opportunity for us to have that new correspondent in Vancouver?
No, we always had a slot for a columnist here in Vancouver. And a lot of our reporters at the SCMP had Canadian connections and do have Canadian connections. But no, that role did not exist. That's something that I sort of lobbied for and kind of made happen, and it's been very successful. You know, I started up a column which was one of the SCMP's most read columns, the Vancouver blog, and there is an almost infinite number of stories that speak to both the Hong Kong community here in Vancouver and the Canadian community back in Hong Kong. That you uncover, you know, you scratch the surface. I'm just scratching the surface of those stories here. There are so many of them because the connections are so deep. There's so much Chinese and Hong Kong money over here. There's so many Chinese and Hong Kong people over here. And the back and forth that exists between Hong Kong and Vancouver, I find fascinating. This sort of netherworld that occupies neither city properly, and you do see people and families kind of divided for years and for decades as they move back and forth between the two cities. And so the crossover, I think, is almost unique in the world, the intensity of that crossover and the relationship between the two.
And was that surprising to you when you moved to Vancouver and started in that position, that it was something that basically for the good part of a decade that you've constantly had this string of news and stories that you're able to tell?
No, it wasn't really that surprising to me. I think it probably surprised a lot of my editors how many of these, you know, Hong Kong and China related exclusives were waiting to be told here in Vancouver. You know, and even if you only apply some relatively basic investigative journalism techniques, like keeping an eye on the court docket, you come up with some amazing stories that are related to Hong Kong and Vancouver. You know, you see the kind of stories you would expect when you have a contingent of, say, billionaires, politicians, retired politicians, movie stars, who are dividing their time between two cities. Those kind of stories that go untold are incredible fodder, I think, for a place like Hong Kong. You know, there's no shortage of celebrities and money and all of the attendant stories that are just waiting to be picked up.
What are some of the stories that you're most fond of that you've worked in since living in Vancouver, Ian, over the last decade or so?
You know, there's been a huge range of them. They've ranged from court stories like the tale of the poor hapless billionaire who was chopped into 108 pieces by his cousin up in West Vancouver. There've been a huge number of stories related to affordability and the way that Chinese money and Hong Kong money have influenced that over the years. There've been some, you know, incredible stories about immigration scams and the various ways that Canadian citizenship is so intensely sought and prized, and that people go to great and sometimes illicit lengths to get that. And I think that those are the kind of stories that actually shaped the city, that actually shaped Vancouver, the way that those processes happen. And I think that for people in Vancouver, a lot of those stories came as a big surprise to them too.
Has there been much action in this part where I'm speaking from at all, Ian, over on the island in Victoria, kind of any of stories of taking you over to this part of the province before?
No, less so, because, you know, 95%+ of moneyed Hong Kongers and Chinese who come to this part of the world end up in Vancouver. And that's not to say that Victoria is not a lovely place. And I would add too that Victoria has a very long history of Chinese connections. It's got one of the oldest Chinatowns in North America, in fact. But the flow of money and the flow of people and talent and that sort of nexus between Hong Kong and this part of the world was very much a Vancouver-Hong Kong nexus. It's something that you don't see outside of BC, really. You see it to a lesser extent in Toronto, a little bit in places like, you know, Calgary maybe. But, I mean, it's very, very much a Vancouver phenomenon.
In terms of what you're currently working on at the moment, Ian, kind of what's the in the news for you currently?
It's all Meng Wanzhou and it's all COVID. But I don't think that's terribly surprising. You know, I think for a lot of reporters, it's all COVID at the moment. But, you know, because the pandemic appears to have started in China, and because a lot of the focus was on China for a very long time, there's a big group of stories very specific to the two locations. The two locations are very interested in how each other is handling that. And the other one, of course, is Meng Wanzhou, which puts Vancouver very much on the cutting edge of this, of the biggest geopolitical story of this half century, which is the rise of China, you know, and how the rest of the world deals with that, how the rest of the world deals with a resurgent and assertive China. How does America deal with that? How does Canada deal with that? And the arrest of Meng Wanzhou will go down as one of those real linchpin moments, one of those key tipping points, I think, that define a history. And when we look back on that moment on December 1st, 2018, I think that's what it will be recognised for, that day that Meng Wanzhou was arrested.
You mentioned before your blog, Hongkouver. Give us a little bit of an idea of this one, sort of scrolling through some of the articles that you've got on there, Ian, some eclectic mixtures of different stories on there. So that must be kind of a bit of a chance maybe when you're not doing these big old serious pieces to do something a little bit more relaxing from time to time.
It is an eclectic mix. I must say it's actually fallen a little bit fallow at the moment because I've been focused very heavily on some pretty serious reporting. But at the same time, I always use the Hongkouver blog not just as a place where I could express my opinions, but also where I could do opinion-based original reporting, you know, where I could combine the two. And that's always a kind of a tricky realm. So I do have to be careful, especially when I'm writing about an ongoing court case like Meng Wanzhou. But, you know, it was very, very well received. And I think that for the Chinese community, it was unusual for them to see the kind of issues that I addressed in the Hongkouver blog being addressed in English. And I think it was an eye-opener for English-speaking readers to see those kind of Chinese community issues being written about in the way that I was.
In terms of your Twitter presence, I do enjoy reading some of your interactions you have on Twitter, Ian. It's sometimes fun to see that one. How do you find sort of Twitter and social media with sort of the work that you do? Because I know there's kind of that some people who don't really like to kind of communicate and back and forth with people who might say things against stories, but other times it's worthy of a bit of a conversation from time to time, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely in the latter camp. I treat Twitter as a conversation, And if a stranger approaches me and has a and is polite and is clearly not an insane person, I'm quite inclined to talk to them. And sometimes that goes off the rails. But I do think that's a benefit. I think that that's a benefit for people to see a journalist who is willing to discuss their stories and discuss other people's ideas openly and in the public eye. Now, if someone has a tip for me, a story tip, I would strongly urge them not to do that in public, but to give that to me in private, to email it to me, to ian.young@scmp.com. But by the same token, I'm quite happy to talk about the journalistic process on Twitter, and I think that surprises a few people. And you know, because of the nature of social media, I think I do end up getting targeted a bit by folk from with various entrenched views. So yeah, it can be interesting, that's for sure.
Makes a bit more entertaining than just a letter to the editor back in the day, right? To the
yeah, the I think Sunshine you do want to be careful. Yes, you do have to be careful though not to fall down that rabbit hole of getting into an argument with someone that doesn't have a productive end. You know, I'm quite happy to get into an argument with someone if there is a productive end to it. And even with a troll, you know, I'm quite happy to try to tease out something valuable out of those exchanges, so long as you don't go berserk and so long as you don't write anything that you would be ashamed for your editor to see. I think is probably that's probably the bottom line for that, me.
Very much so. I think that's a good point. I'll give you an opportunity though, Ian, right now. You mentioned your email address. Plug your social media if people do want to follow what you're up to. Where can they find you?
Well, yeah, they can certainly find me on Twitter. That's at IanJamesYoung70. That's me. But you can, more importantly, if you've got story tips, send them directly to my email address, which is ian.young@scmp.com.
Beautiful, beautiful. And by all means, people, check that out. Ian, before I let you go too, I have to ask from one Australian to another, what do you miss most about Australia? Kind of, is there something that you always long for being in this part of the world that you can't get here?
Well, Ben, what I miss most now are their low COVID numbers. I'm very envious of the way that that Australia and in particular Victoria took it so seriously and came down so hard and so fast on it that they're almost getting their lives back to normal at a time when, you know, we're dealing with the very worst of it here in British Columbia.
Indeed. It certainly is. It's very unique to kind of be outside of that bubble and then sort of see how it is going back where we're originally from. So indeed, definitely an interesting insight there, and it's been a very insightful chat with you today, Ian. A pleasure to speak to you and learn a little bit more about the work that you're doing and your esteemed career. So thank you very much for joining us on the Capital Daily Podcast today.
Thank you, Ben. That was my pleasure.
Coming up, all the day's news plus a unique way to alleviate stress and loneliness during the current pandemic. Next. Get connected to over 41,000 subscribers each day with one of the smartest, largest, and most engaged news audiences on the West Coast, all while supporting Vancouver Island's most dynamic source for in-depth news and analysis. Visit capitaldaily.ca for more details. To the day's news now, and the new Chatlat First Nation is asking the BC government to drop the absurd and expensive argument that the nation abandoned its traditional territory on and around Nootka Island. In the crux of a title case that began in 2017, the small nation asserts that its multi-millennial occupation continued past the point at which it was dispossessed by an 1846 British Sovereignty Declaration. The province argues, as Harshil Sar has reported, that the nation both abandoned its territory and was too marine-based to have truly held it previously. The nation says BC's argument directly contradicts its November 29 commitment to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The declaration states that Indigenous peoples have the right to the lands, territories and resources that they have traditionally owned, occupied or otherwise used or acquired. New Chatlat representatives told the Campbell River Mirror that the province misunderstands traditional ownership and wants to silence the nation in order to pursue resource extraction that damages cultural sites, salmon runs and old-growth forests. More than 1,000 ferry passengers on BC Ferries crossings have remained below decks despite fines. Rules barring ferry passengers from staying in their vehicles on enclosed decks were temporarily waived during the initial months of the pandemic, but reinstated at the end of September. Since reinstatement, there have been more than 1,000 reports of passengers on those decks being unwilling to go upstairs. Transport Canada said the majority of the reports of non-compliance happened shortly after the rule was reinstated. The Times columnist reported that travellers who do not comply with the rules could get a warning or a fine between $600 and $12,000. And Ben Martman has won in a narrow victory in the Cowichan Valley Regional District by-election. Martman beat out Murray McNabb for the Area H Director position by 5 points. He will replace Mary Marcotte, who had held the position from 1997 until last year. And before we go today, if you're feeling a little bit lonely and stressed during the current COVID pandemic, a new activity has emerged that may just help you out. The latest wellness trend coming from the Netherlands sees people hugging cows, or as it is known in Dutch, and apologies to all our Dutch listeners as I try to pronounce this, co-nuffelen. The idea has led one American to create her own platform of animal-based therapy. According to the Toronto Sun, Prairie Conlon is a clinical director of Certipet, a US-based telehealth platform connecting clients looking for animal-assisted therapy. The equine-assisted psychotherapy has been set up at her new ranch outside Madison in Wisconsin, and clients can visit there to participate in sessions with her 17-year-old horse, True, and 7-month-old pony, Snow. The cost ranges from $100 to $300 an hour, and she's also considering adding a mini cow to the herd. It's believed the cow's warmer body temperature, slower heartbeat, and large size can make hugging them a human stress reducer by elevating oxytocin, the hormone released in social bonding. Now, it's an interesting idea, of course, and one that I personally probably wouldn't say no to, although I'm not sure if paying up to $300 an hour to hug a cow is something that is money well spent, particularly when I could just go down to the local supermarket, spend $20 on some steak, and maybe hug that instead. Not sure if that would have the same effect, but at least it would make for a good dinner if it didn't work. And that's it today for the Capital Daily Podcast for Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. A big congratulations to Richard Stewart for his winning photo in last week's Capital Daily Photo Competition. His photo of the Quebec Old City mural called Here, Now and Then was a standout and certainly does look fantastic. If you want to see it, as well as the runners-up in last week's competition, as well as find out how you can enter this week's photo competition, simply check out yesterday's Capital Daily newsletter. My name is Ben Waterworth, and as I say in Australia, happy first day of summer. Thanks for tuning in, and I will speak to you tomorrow. Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by us, Capital Daily. With a committed audience of over 41,000 people, get connected with some of the smartest, hippest people on the West Coast. For more details, visit capitaldaily.ca. The Capital Daily's weekly photo challenge is back for another week. Each week, our team will post a weekly photo theme in Monday's Capital Daily newsletter, as well as announcing it right here on the podcast, with winners receiving gift cards to local Victoria businesses around town. This week's theme is favourite places to hike. To find out how you can enter, check out Monday's Capital Daily newsletter.